Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And again, we're going to turn our attention from the kind of the east side of the state and the north side of the state to the west side of the state and look at the Mississippi River with Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. He comes by every once in a while to talk about life on the Mississippi, and you may have some stories to share as well. Who do you think should be responsible for keeping the river healthy? I hope you'll join in. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. And Reggie McLeod, thanks for joining us once again.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you.
Big River has been covering the driftless area of the Mississippi River for more than 20 years. For those who might not be familiar with the magazine, maybe you can just talk about what you find in every issue. It's pretty eclectic, actually, in some ways.
Sure. There's a lot to write about the Mississippi River. With the new issue, the November-December issue, we've completed 25 years of covering the river. And what I tell people sometimes, and they ask me if we ever have a hard time coming up with story ideas, I say, and this is absolute truth, I say for every story we run, we probably get two new ideas that are just as good. And after 25 years, that still is fortunately the case.
Yeah, you wrote a great article in this edition of Big River about how boundaries can make it hard to deal with problems on the river.
Yes, and that's been of great interest to me because, you know, we cover the river in four states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois, and we're always coming up against that. And, you know, after a while, you become pretty aware that the river is at the edge of attention for politicians and a lot of people, because the Mississippi River is a boundary line between states, and even large rivers within the states are often boundary lines between counties. And we've been using rivers as boundaries for a long time, and the Great Lakes are the same situation. I have to mention this because I grew up on the Great Lakes. I grew up in Trenton, Michigan, which is right where Gros Isle is, which a gentleman called in about a little earlier, and that's right where the Detroit River becomes Lake Erie. And then after that, I lived in Milwaukee for a number of years on the east side near the lake before I moved over to the Mississippi. And the Great Lakes is even a worse situation because those are boundaries between two nations, and that makes it really difficult to solve problems. But on the Mississippi River, you see that all the time. And for instance, the fishing regulations in the Mississippi River are kind of the lowest common denominator between states. In fact, they're even more lax than that because the season stays open 12 months a year on all the fish. So you don't have a fishing season, it's always a fishing season. Of course, the fish move around and behave differently, but it's always open. And it's just not in people's interest to pay attention to it because it's on the edge of their interest, and it's enormously complicated to try to sort things out. There used to be a Minnesota-Wisconsin Boundary Area Commission, which was decommissioned about 15 years ago, I think, to save money, and they were always trying to sort out legal problems and environmental problems between the two states on the river.
And just in the paper today, I saw it in the Wisconsin State Journal, but Josephine McCarty, writing in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, had a piece on the EPA being kind of blasted for some failures along the Mississippi River. And part of that, those failures, I think, are in part due to what you just were talking about.
Yeah, that's true, because the states kind of turned their backs on the river. The federal government really needs to step up, and they've been trying to solve the problem of the nutrients in the river, the phosphorus and nitrogen that creates the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. They've been trying to solve that for quite a while, and it keeps getting worse. And The EPA, it's hard to blame the EPA. I think it would probably be better to look to Congress, because when Congress passed the Clean Water Act back in the 70s, they exempted agriculture. And a lot of the worst pollution from industry and from sewage treatment and that sort of thing has largely been improved, if not, well, not totally solved, but improved greatly. But agriculture has become a worse problem. And Congress has really failed to pass any legislation setting any kind of reasonable minimum standards for agriculture. The worst source of pollution for the stretch of river, up around Prescott, Wisconsin, and above Lake Pepin, the worst source of pollution is the Minnesota River. And the Minnesota River is so polluted because farmers have installed so much drainage tiles to create new cropland, and that drains so many nutrients into the Minnesota River. It's totally changed the hydrology of the river, so that the river goes from being very high to very low very quickly. I mean, it moves between those two states very quickly, so it erodes a lot of the banks and carries an enormous amount of soil into the Mississippi River. And it's kind of sad to say the worst source of pollution in that stretch of the Mississippi is the Minnesota River, which is entirely in the state of Minnesota. And Minnesota could step up and you know, make that better, too, and they failed to do that. This article, I could go on all day, Larry, so feel free to interrupt me. This article is great. I'd recommend it to anyone, and they talk about voluntary programs. And Minnesota has been proposing voluntary programs on the Minnesota River for at least 20 years. I think there have been four or five of our governors have stood on the banks of the Minnesota River and said, we're going to clean up this river, you know, and it's always been voluntary programs, and it's always gotten worse.
Mm.
And I think we need the federal government to step up and make minimum rules that apply to all farmers. That's the only thing that would be fair, because farmers say, well, I can't be competitive if I have to do a better job and it costs me more money, or I can't farm quite as much land. But if all the farmers were following the same rules, that would be fair, and the price of the crops would increase a little bit to cover those costs, or there'd be a little less corn grown, and there might be less expenses for the farmers, and they might make out better that way. But I don't think it's going to work very well unless it's applied fairly to everybody. It's just too big of a problem.
You know, there are a lot of great areas had heavy rains this past year, and you did mention a little bit about runoff, but those rains had some effect on the Mississippi River and the areas around it.
Oh, yeah. It's hugely changed. We have the Driftless area, which is the area that we cover, and that's the Twin Cities, well, just below the Twin Cities to just above the Quad Cities. We have all these deep valleys and 400 or 500-foot bluffs. So if you get a large rainfall, it's like pouring something into a big funnel. Those valleys funnel the water quickly into rivers, and people die. You know, houses slide off of hillsides because the water is so saturated, and this is all because of the effects of global climate change. We have we have fewer rains, but we have more really heavy rains, and the river never used to be high this time of year. It was usually pretty low, and it was actually at a record high right along the Wisconsin boundary for a couple weeks late in the summer. And last year it was setting a record from mid-fall almost to February. Every single day the river set a new record for high water during that stretch. So the climates, I mean, your last guest was talking about how climate change is going to affect things. Well, I have to say, you know what, it's already affected things drastically. I mean, it's already here, and it's already having a large effect on people's lives and the environment and the river and the Great Lakes, too.
Yeah, there was even train derailment in Ferryville, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the tracks washed out, and that's happened before. I mean, that's not the first time that's happened. We've had a lot of cases where tracks have washed out, roads, a lot of roads washed out on the floods earlier this summer in Buffalo County. They had two heavy rains that caused floods within a couple weeks, and the same happened, and that's in Wisconsin. The same happened in the northeast Iowa. Decorah, Iowa had a big flood, and a couple weeks later they had another big flood in the same place. And these are sometimes record rainfalls that we're having. New records are frequent, and they shouldn't be. And that's another big problem. But that makes it harder to deal with the river problems, because all the bridges we've engineered and the roads and the railroad tracks, they were all engineered using tables and numbers that are no longer true. They all are going to have to be rebuilt if they're going to be serving the purpose that they're intended to serve.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, it's not, fortunately, it's not all gloom and doom. There's a lot of kind of really cool things that you cover in the magazine that I want to spend some time talking about as well. We can talk about the issues, some of the problems, but we can also talk about some of the cool things that I read about in Big River Magazine, and we're going to do that. Reggie McLeod is our guest. Reggie is editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, and we will. He's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. We're going to take a look at the news and the weather and find out what else is in store for us, and then we can talk about things like riverboat gambling and gray foxes and a whole lot more. Stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, talking about the Upper Mississippi River today with Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. You may have a favorite spot along the Mississippi and want to talk about it. Maybe you've noticed some changes, ecological changes along the river in recent years. I hope you'll join in our conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. The page title is The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to see your photos as well of the Mississippi. If you have some, I'd love to point them out to people as we visit with Reggie McLeod. And Reggie, one of the articles, this is kind of a cool piece on the recent history of riverboat gambling. Interesting history of how riverboat gambling came back to the river. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, for a while, especially in Iowa and Illinois, they allowed gambling only, and this is not including Indian casinos, which comes under a whole different set of laws, but they allowed gambling only in riverboats, and the riverboats had to go out and cruise, and in some cases they had to actually be out cruising when people were gambling. And the story kind of talks about the evolution of that, because slowly over the years they've kind of cut back the requirements where they just had to go out and cruise like maybe an hour a day or a certain amount of time a day. And when they did that, a lot of the boats would just go out at 6 o'clock in the morning and go up downstream, back upstream, downstream, and tie up and then open. And finally, they've kind of nudged the rules so that even for a while, the gambling had to be over water. So they were building casinos inland over ponds or pools. And I think all of that stuff is pretty much gone now. So they've moved all the casinos, but one in our area, off the river, back inland now. And the only one that's left is at Marquette, Iowa, which is across the river from Prairie du Chien. There's a small boat there where they have a casino, and there's no, it doesn't cruise. But still, some of the gambling is set up in such a way that the casinos are actually owned by a nonprofit which kind of serves as a foundation and distributes the profits to nonprofit organizations in the area. And a number of environmental groups have benefited from funds from those nonprofits. So River Action in the Quad Cities gets a lot of funding from the gambling industry in the Quad Cities. And Marquette has used a lot of money kind of to develop the town and to build an environmental center. I believe that some of that money went for that, too. So it's been a slow evolution, but it's kind of sad to see it leave the river.
I was thinking about my mother, rest her soul. The one time in her life that she ever gambled was some part of a tour of some sort, and they wound up on a part of the tour was on one of those river boats, and she gambled and actually won money.
Oh, right, yeah. The first time I did, I think I won $20, and I took my girlfriend out for lunch and got out of there before I lost it again.
Oh, boy. That was her one and only time for her, too. I think she won about $20 as well. Frank in Hartford has something for us. Hi, Frank. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. You know, I have heard quite a bit about freshwater pearls coming out of the Mississippi, and is it too polluted to still produce them? And if not, are there public places where you could get in the water and look for them?
Oh,
boy, that's a good question. Well, where most of the pearls came from, they're really rare in freshwater mussels. In fact, when I was a kid, I heard about that, and I hesitate to even admit it now. I killed a lot of mussels looking for pearls, and I never did manage to find one. But back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was a huge clamming industry on the upper Mississippi River, and they harvested clams that they then used the shells to cut into mother-of-pearl buttons. And those buttons that are probably on most of our shirts right now are plastic that's made to look like mother of pearl. But for a long time, the Mississippi River in Muscatine, Iowa, most of all, was the pearl button capital of the world. They exported pearl buttons all around the world, and there were factories in Lansing, Iowa, and Muscatine, and in a lot of the river towns. On Lake Pepin, there was a huge industry on Lake Pepin, too, with harvesting mussels and making buttons. So when they harvested those mussels, they were always on the lookout for pearls in there, and often they just put them in their pocket or something. There wasn't a big market. In fact, there are a couple jewelers, one in Lake City, Minnesota on Lake Pepin, and the other one in Alma, Wisconsin, that make a lot of jewelry out. They specialize in jewelry made from river pearls. And they'll go around trying to find pearls in antique shops or auction sales. And sometimes they'll come across like an old mason jar full of river pearls. But I wouldn't recommend going out there and killing mussels in order to find pearls, because you might have to kill 1,000 of them or something.
To find one, maybe.
Yeah, it'd be better to go to one of these jewelry shops and buy you can get, you know, rings and earrings and necklaces made out of Mississippi River pearls. And those are old pearls found when they were doing clamming. They did clamming more recently, and they would use those shells to form the little spheres that then in Asia they would grow cultured pearls on those spheres, and the oysters would coat those and turn them into, you know, cultured pearls. But that has pretty much ceased. There's not much of that going on, and it's against the law in most of the states now, too, just because of a lot of the species of pearls are endangered.
Yeah. You had a nice piece on that button industry in a previous, I can't remember what issue it was, but it was an interesting story about that button industry.
Yeah, it was a good article, and it was about a button factory closing in Lansing, Iowa, and they had a button factory there for over 100 years, and this factory basically just put plastic buttons onto the cards that they were displayed on and sold. They just finally shut the doors on that. It was bought by another company that was bought by another company, you know, how that goes. But they had been going there continuously for, it's a riverboat captain started it originally.
There you go, Frank. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You had some beautiful photos, actually, of gray foxes. One's on your cover, and I don't know who, I've forgotten who took those photos, but there's a cool story that you've got in there about foxes that are, and they're great tree climbers.
Yes, and that was Herb Lang that took the photos. He's
right.
From down in the Dubuque area. He took the cover photo. I've always been kind of fascinated by this, and we do critter stories, and we find more and more unusual ones to go so we don't have to repeat ourselves. And these foxes climb trees like cats. In fact, I guess when people see them, they mistake them for cats. And I've seen plenty of red foxes and gotten quite close to them. I've never seen a gray fox. And I just don't look up in trees to see snakes and foxes. And not this time of year, you're not going to see snakes. But in the summer, you might see a fox. And there are a lot of snakes that spend much of their life up in trees, too. So we had Kenny Solway do a story on gray foxes for us, because of course Kenny spends a lot of time in the woods.
Yeah.
And he's seen plenty of gray foxes.
And they're interesting because, as the story points out, they have long claws, and they're only, well, they weigh 10-12 pounds.
Yeah, they're pretty small, and they just walk. They can, well, usually, and I was talking to Kenny about this, about, because I was trying to get some tips on how I can see them myself, and he says they usually climb up trees that are leaning, you know, that have fallen part way over, and they sometimes have their nests up in those trees, and that's where he's usually seen them. So I'm going to be out there trying to spot them here.
There we go.
Yeah.
Let's go to Lisa in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Lisa.
Hello.
What can we do for you today?
He was just talking about the button factory in Lansing, and I'm from Lansing. And I remember when I was a kid, we used to find all the old shells that they used to throw out on the riverbanks from where they punched the buttons out.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. And the fishing, I believe the river has gotten cleaner, because even in the past year, last year the fish were not biting. This year I have caught every kind of fish everywhere I go. And I fish every day. My grandfather always said, every day you fish adds a half hour to your life.
That's a good story. Well, that's great. Thank you, Lisa, for calling. Reggie, what about the fishing?
Yes, I agree. The fishing has gotten better the last few years, and I think part of it is there are more, I hate to call them weeds, but that's what most of us call the plants that grow in the river, and lakes are weeds, but they're actually submergent vegetation, and there's a lot of kind of new ones coming back, and I think they provide a lot of shelter for the fish, especially for the young fish that are growing up. Then they can hide, and they have things to eat, and I think that's helped. In fact, the river was choked with weeds a few years ago. Mm-hmm. People couldn't fish because they would get their line tangled up so easily, but boy, after that, it seems like the fishing keeps getting better, and this year, I heard all these stories about people catching giant perch, and I didn't catch any. I'll try. They'll be there next year. But, we've had a lot of good fishing. I've had a lot of fun in the last few years out on the river fishing, and I've seen a lot of big fish of all sorts. And people, you know, I never saw many perch on the river until the last year or two, and suddenly there are all these big perch. So something's improving for sure, and the waterfowl have been doing pretty good too, and the eagles have been expanding, and there's a lot more pelicans. The pelicans are one of my favorite birds, and the swans are coming through right now. There's a lot of swans, and this is a good thing to take your, if you're around the river, you might find a good place to spot swans. One of the best places is south of La Crosse by the Goose Island County Park there, or across the river from there, which is just south of Brownsville, Minnesota. There's places you can go and see thousands of swans at one time. In fact, there are so many of them, they create a huge noise. One time I was driving up the river road this time of year, and I pulled off there by Brownsville, and the racket was amazing. They were not sleeping. I don't know how those birds managed to fly all that way without getting a good night's sleep, but the racket was just incredible. So, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff going on, too.
Yeah. Thanks, Lisa. Jeff in La Crosse has a different kind of fish to talk about here, bullheads. Jeff from La Crosse, go ahead.
Yeah, Reggie, we used to sit down along Highway 35 there in the Goose Island Stoddard vicinity and catch bullheads in the spring, you know, 5-gallon buckets full. Mm-hmm. And I haven't heard of anybody catching a bluehead or bullheads for a number of years now. I wonder if you've heard anything about what happened to the bullheads.
No, I haven't heard a good explanation of that. And things kind of go up and down. You know, you suddenly you see a lot more perch, and it seems like there are fewer bullheads. I drive in. One of my favorite places to hike around in the winter is the Trempealeau Refuge, just north of Trempealeau, Wisconsin. And there were always guys fishing for bullheads near the entry road there. And the last few years, I mean, it's been 3 or 4 years since I've seen anyone even fishing for bullheads in there. And I ask around, and that's what they said. They're not there. And that's even cut off from the river. So, I mean, even though that's affected by a lot of the same conditions that affect the river, it's not really connected to the river. And I think they've kind of declined around there. So things run in cycles, I guess, is what biologists often tell me. They say some cycles are a couple years, and some are, you know, might be 10 or 11 years. And so, I don't know.
No, that's a mystery, but it's probably a cycle, and they may well come back at some point.
Yeah, and I've been hearing it from a lot of people, though, that they can't find them anymore.
Hmm.
They'll have to fish for perch, I guess.
Yeah, Jeff, thanks for calling. Elton and Beaver Dam, your turn now. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I've got a quick comment and then a quick question then a comment, if I could.
Sure.
The question is, I like to say that I grew up on the east coast of Nebraska because I grew up within a mile of the Missouri River, and it's always kind of irritated me that the Missouri River is the longest tributary of the Mississippi. Why is it when they join up in St. Louis, does it become the Mississippi River or stay the Mississippi River rather than, you know, becoming the Missouri River? I've always wondered that.
My short answer is I don't know. I've talked about that so much with so many people, and every once in a while we get an article or somebody has proof of it, but I think it's just a subjective thing. I think it's just a matter of the first guy who draws the map. Because you're right, you know, and the Ohio River probably has a larger volume of water than the Mississippi River does a lot of the time, too. And some people have said, well, the Ohio's a bigger river. That should be the Mississippi River. I hate to say, I think it's arbitrary. I've been trying to get someone to do a good story on how they make decisions like that. I've always thought it should be something scientific, like the cross-section of the river, where they join together, or the volume of water for the whole year, the average volume of water, or the length. And no one wants to do that because I don't think there's any system to it.
Okay, and my comment harkens back to your discussion about contamination in the last hour. And I've worked as an environmental chemist for the last 30-plus years. And measuring air pollution. And something that people don't seem to realize is that if you put anything anywhere, water, soil, air, it gets into everything else. For example, when we can measure atrazine when there's total snow cover on Wisconsin. We can measure atrazine in the air when there's spraying in southern Iowa and Illinois. So I mean, it travels, and a lot of the products that we use, deodorants and the air fresheners, musks, perfumes, contain chemicals. The smells that you're smelling are endocrine disruptors, and you know this isn't a matter of general awareness. And we just blithely go along and assume that things are going to be okay if we use this thing because it's on the shelf, but. Our culture has set up a situation where we've set a lot of things in motion that we don't think about, we don't know about, and they have significant effects, and you know, such as feminizing fish in rivers. And I don't know if that's a problem of the Mississippi at this point, but I just thought I'd put that comment out there and let people mull it over.
Sure. Thank you so much, Elton. Reggie, a comment from you.
Yeah. Oh, I agree absolutely. You know, when there was a tidal wave in the disaster at the Fukushima nuclear plant, a couple months later, well, even less than that, they were getting higher radiation levels in California. I mean, the Pacific. You're talking about a big hunk of water, and then pretty soon debris was washing up on the coast of California and Oregon and Washington from Japan with that. But also. And we don't get political with the magazine. We just talk about issues. But, you know, a lot of people want politicians to solve their problems. And the decisions that we make in everyday life, the things we use, our habits, the way we live, all those things affect the world. And it really doesn't make any difference who's in office and who's doing what or not doing what. You know, if when people change the way they live, that changes the world, you know, whatever's happening politically. And I think that's important. And you don't want to just put it off and wait for someone else to do something.
Yeah. Well, I, Elton, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it. I think he probably agrees with you on that. He may well agree with you on that. Before we go further, tell us how people can get copies of Big River Magazine. You're online. I think we have an address. We have a link to our. Yeah, Chris says. Yeah, we got a link on our Facebook page. The Larry Mueller Show to Big River Magazine, but
yeah, the magazine. That's right. I should be selling magazines here, Larry. Yes, they can call us at 1-800-303-8201, or you can go to our website, which is easy. That's BigRiverMagazine.com. And we have a lot of stories on there from past issues, and there are other books and things we have about the river that are for sale on there, and a lot of good links to, you know, the DNRs and different environmental groups and reports and activities, and a great map of the area that has a lot of overlooks on the river and parks and boat ramps and things like that, too.
Yeah. So, always fun, Reggie. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Time goes really fast, Larry. I always enjoy it.
Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. I had a lot of fun talking with him. I always do. He comes by every couple months or so, and we talk about the Mississippi River. Well, here we've got tomorrow at 11 o'clock. I hope you'll tune in for the annual Splendid Table Turkey Confidential special with Lynn Risotto Casper. Then at noon, we'll talk with the author of the book Into the Nest. So I hope you can spend some time of your holiday with us for that. And certainly, I hope you have a great Thanksgiving. Spend some time with family and friends and have a wonderful time. And stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Net.